CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Joseph Ellis. His new book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783. Not just what happens on the battlefield, but how it's thought about before and after, what it means. We now go to the summer of 1782. John Jay, a man who I would want for my attorney in eternity. Good heavens, he is clever. This man comes forward with a suggestion one summer's evening in France, chatting with the Spanish ambassador to France, Count Aranda. They're pausing over a map. They're debating the future if and when Britain seeks to end the war. They're looking at a map of the continent, what they have. Count Aranda, and this is Spain. France gave up its continental empire when it was defeated in the 1763. Spain, however, has a portion of it, you will recall, a very large portion of it that will be caught, will become critical for the expansion of the United States in the 19th century. But right now, Count Aranda's looking at a line he draws somewhere between Ohio and the middle of Florida, Florida being a Spanish possession at the time. John Jay cleverly leans forward and finds the Mississippi and points out the Mississippi. Professor, this is an amazing moment. It's the moment where America becomes an empire. Did they recognize it at that moment when John Jay rushed to tell Franklin what had happened?
They didn't hear about it for another 6 weeks, but it was a big decision. And of course, they didn't have cell phones then. And he couldn't call back to Philadelphia to get instructions. And he had instructions that he had to go along with the French. And that meant he had to go along with the Spanish, who had a treaty with the French. So he's breaking his orders here. And he's saying, there are two things that you know that independence is non-negotiable. Now I'm telling you the Mississippi border as our western border is non-negotiable, too. I mean, it's a bold act by a man of extraordinary intelligence and wisdom, John Jay. I think I was confusing him with earlier comments with Dickinson, but I apologize for that. But this is Jay's big moment, and the result is the most lopsided diplomatic treaty in American history. Comes at the very beginning.
Jay deserves to be on the $100 bill, Professor. Because
maybe, you know, if we take Jefferson's statue down in the government in New York or New Albany, maybe they ought to put up a big one to Jay. He's actually worthy of that.
They're going to make a separate peace. That's daring, isn't it? Very much so. That breaks with France in some fashion.
That's right. They break their orders. They violate their orders. Jay goes back to Franklin's quarters and says, I've just decided we're going to break our orders. Franklin is, it takes him a day or two to get used to that. Adams comes down from the Netherlands where he is, and he's told what Jay did. And he said, great. I think it's great that we should break our orders. Because he later says that Jay, he said the peace treaty was a success because of one person. And usually when Adams says that, he's referring to himself. But in this particular case, that person is John Jay.
More providence here. Lord North has resigned, the man who led the cabinet during the failures of the war. A man named Shelburne takes over. He collapses. So it goes to, I believe, Rockingham. Germain is just exhausted with bad feeling. Let's go back to the colonies now. What we've seen repeatedly for these last several years is that Congress doesn't believe in the Continental Army, doesn't think it should pay for the Continental Army. What was the thinking at Congress?
That same thing, that once the war is over, the Continental Army will be disbanded, and it couldn't happen any. They want it to happen quickly. They promised them some form of a pension, but the Treasury is about $400,000 in debt, and there's no money, so they're going to be sent away with nothing. And when the Society of the Cincinnati gets created as a way of honoring the service of officers in the Continental Army, it's demonized as a aristocratic institution. People go back to Connecticut, their hometowns, and they're told to leave. They don't want to live there anymore. So that it's an anti anti-army posture throughout most of the country. And again, in retrospect, it's difficult for us to understand and or to explain.
Did the officers who had not been paid and the enlisted men who had not been paid, did they hold it against Washington, against Congress? How did they explain it to themselves?
I think the senior officers didn't hold it against Washington, but the junior officers did. Washington was kind of an aloof guy, and he didn't confer with them as often. Some of them thought he should have been willing to take their side more strongly, although that meant risking, becoming dictator. When they meet for the final meeting of the officers at a tavern in New York, only about half the senior officers show up. And that's a measure of the fact that many of the others were disappointed in Washington.
Let's explore how they were paid, or at least how they were promised to be paid. A man you say has been rescued, thanks to biographies most recently, having spent a couple of centuries being derided as a war profiteer. Who is Robert Morris, and what is his part?
Robert Morris is called the financier of the American Revolution. He's probably the wealthiest man in Philadelphia and maybe the wealthiest man in America. He's an immigrant and comes to America as a young boy, and at a very early age involved in a mercantile house in Philadelphia and establishes a company, which is the major trading company in Japan, in the Caribbean, as well as North America and the Mediterranean. And during the war, he uses his credit to promote trade with Europe, with France, that's illegal trade. Morris's credit was worth more than American credit. And if Morris promised you that he was going to pay you back, you knew that you would get it. If America does, you knew you'd never going to get it. When the Yorktown expedition is perched north of New York and they have to get from there down to Yorktown, there's no way they can do it. They don't have the funds to get the transport. And Morris says, "What does it cost?" And Washington said $175,000. He said, "Here's a check." When the army is being disbanded in Newburgh and they're not getting a pension, he says it's immoral and that every person should get a check for something like $700. And so he writes over 10,000 checks and nearly bankrupts himself in the process. So in my interpretation of this man, he's not the robber baron that he appears in many earlier histories. He's a real patriot. He eventually loses his fortune in land investors and ends up in debtor's prison, where Washington actually visits him during his presidency. He was highly regarded in his own time than he has been subsequently. And I think we should recover the way he was seeing that.
The thinking about the cause is now critical because while the battles are over, the future is indistinct. It's fog of thinking. Washington thinks continentally. Robert Morris does as well. However, that is resented by, I think, the Congress, certainly by the states, who are very powerful, especially Virginia and New York. They resent it.
Right.
So we come to this conflict that still isn't resolved, Joseph. It's not resolved whether the states or the central government is more important. We have this idea of co-sovereignty or shared sovereignty. However, Washington's frustration is obvious because he wants an independent, and he sees an independent state, and he sees that what they have is a larger landmass than Europe. They have the biggest empire in the world if they think about it. Who did he complain to? Who listened to him in Congress? Anyone?
There were people that listened, but by then Congress itself couldn't enforce anything it did anyway. The government under the Articles of Confederation place sovereignty clearly in the hands of the states and the state legislatures. And so what you're pointing to is, the way I put it, is that the first line in the most famous speech in American history is historically incorrect. Lincoln at Gettysburg said 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. They brought forth a confederation of sovereign states, provisionally united to win the war under the banner of the cause, and after that was won, to go their separate ways. So the government that exists after the war is over in 1783 resembles very much the government the Confederacy will want in 1860-61. And for that reason, it's not a government capable of addressing the two great looming tragedies that are going to befall the founding. One is a fair assessment, a fair just treatment of the indigenous peoples of America. And secondly, putting slavery on the road to extinction. Those are the looming problems, and they're not prepared politically to deal with them at all by the end of the war.
The book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783. Joseph Ellis is the author. When we come back, The Remains of the War. I'm John Bashan.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.